Well, good morning. This is Jeff Blankford, welcoming you to the April 27th edition of Takes on the World, a public affairs program that comes your way the second and fourth Wednesdays of every month and every other fifth Wednesday when I open the phones to you, our listeners. By now, if nothing else, the American people have discovered more than they ever knew about how undemocratic and unrepresentative is the system to elect our presidents that the nation's founders put in place over two centuries ago in order to keep the masses of the people from having a direct say in deciding who will be their president. Sure, everyone was aware of the Electoral College, but I suspect not the degree to which political parties, which have made no mention whatsoever in the Constitution, have succeeded in privatizing the electoral process, leaving it to their respective state operations to determine how the numbers of delegates can be allocated regardless of the outcome at the polls. And just to make sure they have the candidate of the party establishment wants heading to the ballot, unquote, unquote, Democratic Party has appointed hundreds of so-called superdelegates, which include all current and former Democratic officials, among them some who have since become corporate lobbyists. And those superdelegates have been counted by the media as if the votes had already been cast. Let's call it for what it is, hypocrisy with a capital H. Some of the elected governments in our hemisphere have been having a rough time lately, but not so much as the people who put them in office. One of them, oil-rich Venezuela, home to what was once hailed as the Bolivarian Revolution, and its now deceased leader Hugo Chavez as Latin America's successor to Fidel Castro, has been in economic and political freefall for months, brought about by a government corruption, U.S.-backed opposition, and the fallen price of oil. How the Western left has responded to the Venezuelan situation is one of the subjects that will be explored when, at 20 minutes past the hour, I'll be speaking once again to Venezuelan-born professor Pedro Lango-Shurian from the University of San Francisco, so stay tuned for that. Until then, I'm going to focus on one of the most touchiest subjects when it comes to our electoral and political processes, speaking aloud about the significance of Jewish money and the influence of the pro-Israel lobby in deciding who wins and loses in our elections. Well, a number of books have been written about the lobby's influence for years from a variety of political perspectives. It's not one you're likely to hear mentioned or discussed on AM or FM radio for fear of being labeled anti-Semitic. That goes double when it comes to speaking about the money, despite the larger-than-life presence of billionaire Sheldon Adelson, who already has held three auditions for Republican candidates at his Venetian Hotel in Las Vegas, and on the Democratic side, Israeli-American media mogul Haim Saban, who has given already more than $30 million to both Clintons and their foundation. So it wasn't exactly a public discussion, however, 10 days ago, when on the first night of J Street's convention in Washington, D.C., there was an unusually open discussion about the extent of Jewish influence on our national elections. J Street, for those unaware of its existence, is a liberal pro-Israel Jewish lobbying organization in Washington, founded in 2007 with major funding from George Soros. It declares itself to be both pro-Israel and pro-peace, while positioning itself to the left, relatively speaking, of AIPAC, American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, which in recent years has moved away from its traditional nonpartisanship to embrace the Republican Party and the Netanyahu agenda. While supporting continuing unconditional U.S. military to Israel, aid to Israel, J Street opposes Israel's settlement policy, supports a two-state resolution of the Israel-Palestine conflict, and supported the administration's nuclear deal with Iran, which was a minority position within the Jewish political establishment. According to its website, it, quote, supports a new direction for American policy in the Middle East, diplomatic solutions over military ones, multilateral over unilateral approaches to conflict resolution, and dialogue over confrontation with wider international support. On the evening of April 17th, J Street hosted a panel at a Washington synagogue entitled Pundits, Pollsters, and Politicos, among them NPR's Mara Pliason, and the head of the Pew Research, Alan Cooperman. New York Times columnist Roger Cohen was the moderator. When Cohen asked J.J. Goldberg of The Forward, editor-at-large of the New York Jewish Weekly, to explain the importance of funding to pro-Israel politics, Goldberg responded, "Funding?" Then he gave an uncomfortable little laugh and said, Up until recently, I was under the impression that the Democratic had to go to Jews. You ask a Democratic fundraiser, where do you get the money from? Well, from trial lawyers, from toys, from generic drugs, from Hollywood, from Jews. Those are all essentially Jewish industries, noted Goldberg. When you're raising money, you need to find rich people who are not right-wing, and there are not, pardon me for saying this, said Goldberg, there are not many rich goyim who are not right-wing. Forgive me for saying that, quote. For those not familiar with the term goyim, it's a largely deprecating Yiddish word for non-Jews, although it seems Goldberg meant that in a humorous way. Then Goldberg said he had just read something, quote, that knocked my socks off, end quote. And then he goes on to say the Center for Responsive Politics had issued a list of the top 50 donors to the 527 PACs and super PACs and discovered that 8 of the 36 Republican biggies were Jewish and 14 top Democrats, only one was not Jewish. Goldberg's candor about the Jewish weight on the Democratic side apparently liberated the one person on the panel who wasn't Jewish. It was Stephanie Shirok, president of Emily's List, the well-known pro-choice group that has been working and funding pro-choice women candidates since 1985. When questioned by Roger Cohen, here's what she had to say.
You've advised a lot of politicians over the years on these issues, and tell us what it was like in the past when you were advising somebody beginning a campaign in terms of what had to be said or not said to win the Jewish vote, and how that's different today, if it is.
Well, as I've listened to all of these amazing comments and a lot of conversation about the Jewish vote, I think the main question that was asked to JJ was about the money. I think that is a big piece of this story and cannot be overlooked at all. I was thinking of some of the conversations I had over the summer with some of our federal candidates. Emily's List works with 50-plus federal candidates every year. Most of those federal candidates have been in the state legislature or haven't run before at all. They have not looked beyond their cities, let alone their state borders. Goodness gracious, there's another world out there beyond the United States. And they jump in to this really trying to change the economy and build jobs and, you know, help their communities. And this issue is very, very far, not just in the eyes of the voters, as we just heard, but in the eyes of so many of our candidates. And so when something like the Iran deal came up early in an election cycle where we already had candidates running who were not going to take a vote but were asked for position, there was a lot of angst over what to do and how to handle that. And these are folks who have not been briefed, do not have access to these briefings, do not have any of the information other than what they're reading in the newspaper. And it was a really trying time to help guide the candidates. And someone who's been doing this now for 2 decades, I realized that I had the freedom as an operative, as a strategist, to say to some of our candidates, which I in fact did, is do what you feel is right here. Because we...
As Bernie Sanders did the other night, presumably.
Exactly, because I think there is enough, there's enough energy around all of it now than there used to be. So if you decide to be against the deal, there's going to be folks that are going to be with you. If you're going to be for the deal, there's going to be folks that are going to be with you. Now, I say that was the first time I went, wow.
Well, what
there's
about,
really
what about
a change
you,
well, because in the, I was insane.
What about if you said, what about if you said, well, I want to say that I believe Israel should stop building settlements and get out of most of the West Bank. What advice? Would that be going too far?
I would send them straight to J Street. And by the way, I do, so thank you. And that is a significant difference here. So I started as a finance director. I worked for candidates in the 90s as their finance director, and I would come on a congressional race. I'm a 20-something kid who also knows nothing beyond the state borders, let alone overseas. and you thought about where you're going to go to raise the money that you needed to raise to win a race. And you went to labor, and you went to the choice community, and you went to the Jewish community. But before you went to the Jewish community, you had a conversation with the lead AIPAC person in your state, and they made it clear that you needed a paper on Israel. And so you called all of your friends who already had a paper on Israel that was designed by AIPAC, and we made that your paper. This was before there was a campaign manager or a policy director or field director, because you got to raise money before you do all that. I have written more Israel papers than you can imagine. I'm from Montana. I barely knew where Israel was until I looked at a map. And the poor campaign manager would come in, or the policy director, and I'd be like, here's your paper on Israel. This is our policy. We've sent it all over the country because this is how we've raised money. And so you ask, what does that mean? That means these candidates who, you know, were farmers or school teachers or businesswomen ended up having an Israel position without having any significant conversation.
But you're saying all Israel papers were the same. They were identical.
Very similar. Incredibly similar.
I mean, for a country, of more than 300 million people with lots of different views on lots of different subjects, that's a pretty amazing cornering of the market, isn't it?
It's astounding. And when I look back at it, it's shocking.
And that was Stephanie Sherrock, head of Emily's List, speaking on a panel in Washington on April 17th. And though if you search hard, you'll find the entire panel discussion on YouTube, and it's worth watching, listening to. I suspect you will not hear what I just played for you on any other radio program. The panel took place 2 days after Bernie Sanders did something during a presidential debate, which Roger Cohn referenced, with Hillary Clinton in Brooklyn that had never been done before. He criticized a prime minister of the state of Israel, saying that Netanyahu was not always right and that we are going to have to treat the Palestinian people with respect and dignity, and that Israel used a disproportionate attack during its 50-day war in Gaza in 2014. Sanders also criticized Clinton's speech before AIPAC for not reflecting on the reality of the Palestinians. As mild as all that was, it represents a breakthrough. He received a huge round of applause for his comments at the debate in Brooklyn, and the sky did not fall down. Sanders did lose New York, and after last night's results, the chances of him gaining the Democratic Party nomination have become realistically non-existent. But he speaks to the young people of America who are no longer willing to buy into the party establishment lines put forth by Clinton and her backers, and particularly so when it comes to the Israel-Palestine conflict, where Israel, in party parlance, could do no wrong. The cracks in that support were evident at the 2012 Democratic Convention, when after the platform committee had refused to include statements praising God and recognizing Jerusalem as Israel's capital. The frustrated chair of the committee attempted to get the convention delegates to overrule the committee's decision. It made for a moment of comedy, which I played for you at that time, but it sent shivers up and down the backs of the Democratic establishment. It's worth listening to again, since the party bigwigs have apparently stacked the platform committee this time with pro-Israel delegates to make sure there's no repeat performance in July when Philadelphia during the convention. So the first voice you hear will be that of Antonio Villaraigosa, the former mayor of Los Angeles and a darling of the city's pro-Israel community, who was presiding over that part of the convention in 2012.
Recognizes the delegate from Ohio, the chair of the platform drafting committee, former governor Ted Strickland.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, I move that we suspend the rules to permit an amendment to the platform adopted by this convention last night.
Governor Strickland has made a motion on the floor to suspend the rules. Is there a second? A motion to suspend the rules to permit the amendment to the platform has been moved and seconded. This is a non-debatable motion requiring a two-thirds vote. All of those in favor of suspending the rules, say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, say no. In the opinion of the chair, there's been a two-thirds affirmative vote to suspend the rules. Governor, would you like to make your motion?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This summer, I was proud to serve this party as the Platform Drafting Committee chair. As the chair, I come before you today to discuss two important matters related to our party's national platform. As an ordained United Methodist minister, I am here to attest and affirm that our faith and belief in God is central to the American story and informs the values we've expressed in our party's platform. In addition, President Obama recognizes Jerusalem as the capital of Israel, and our party's platform should as well. Mr. Chairman, I have submitted my amendment in writing, and I believe it is being projected on the screen for the delegates to see. I move adoption of the amendment as submitted and shown to the delegates.
A motion has been made. Is there a second? Is there any further discussion? Hearing none, the matter requires a two-thirds vote in the affirmative. All those delegates in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those delegates opposed say no.
No.
In the opinion of the... Let me do that again. All of those delegates in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those delegates opposed say no.
A silly grin comes across his face.
I guess.
You've got a rule, and then you've got to let them do what they're going to do. Rule.
I'll do that one more time. All those delegates in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those delegates opposed say no. In the opinion of the chair, two-thirds have voted in the affirmative. The motion is adopted, and the platform has been amended as shown on the screen.
And that was 2012. It's clear, watching the sound recording of that, that in each occasion, the no votes slightly exceeded the yes votes. The nose against the eyes. Well, as I mentioned, the party establishment has packed this year's platform committee to make sure such a vote doesn't come to the floor in Philadelphia. We'll see. Finally, another story you're not likely to hear or read about. 83 senators, 51 Republicans, and 31 Democrats have signed a letter to President Obama to ask him to approve a larger defense aid package for Israel, something the president has already agreed to do. So it's just about these senators seeking 2016 campaign funding from Israel's well-heeled backers and nothing more. You're not going to read about it. But the letter, initiated by Delaware Democrat Chris Coons and South Carolina Republican hawk Lindsey Graham, stated that, quote, in light of Israel's dramatically rising defense challenges, we stand ready to support a substantially enhanced new long-term agreement to help provide Israel the resources it requires to defend itself and preserve its qualitative military edge, end quote. Israel currently receives $3.1 billion a year military aid from the U.S. While the letter did not suggest a specific figure, Israel wants between $4 and $4.5 billion annually as part of a new defense package for the next decade. Obama administration officials, meanwhile, have proposed a lower figure of $3.7 billion, but that's apparently not enough for our greedy allies. Presidential candidate Ted Cruz was among the letter's signatories, while Bernie Sanders was not, nor, as I have been told, were Barbara Boxer or Dianne Feinstein. Speaking to the Times of Israel last month, Graham, chairman of the Senate Subcommittee on State Foreign Operations and Related Programs, he vowed to, quote, do everything I can to squeeze some money out of a tight budget to help increase funding for Israel, end quote. That's Lindsey Graham. This has been Jeff Blankfort. Thank you for listening.